I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one turns on two new books, two fresh angles on the USA as military colossus, two perspectives that you will not forget once you've seen them. Also, two points of view that I can almost guarantee you you'll never see on page one of the New York Times. One book is about military real estate, 900 plus U.S. military bases around the world, many of them toxic, more and more of them under local protest. The other book is about the cultural process, the technology, the media, the narrative storyline, the TV and the computer graphics of military power in the 21st century. Two great stars of the Watson Institute make this occasion. The anthropologist Catherine Lutz edited the first book on the menu here. It's called The Bases of Empire, The Global Struggle Against U.S. Military Posts. And James Dudarian wrote the second, titled Virtuous War, Mapping the Military, Industrial, Media, Entertainment Network. Kathy Lutz, your book shakes up a mindset that I, and I think all of us, draw vaguely from World War II. When we think of airfields in Guam or military hospitals in Germany, we half assume that those foreign installations work for the foreigners in terms of jobs and security and all that. And we also assume that they invited us. Furthermore, that our GIs are pretty good guests, and that if you believe in viral terror out there, you assume that these things are, whatever the cost, good to have. Now tell us what's really going on out there.
Okay. Well, that story is, as you say, a very popular story about U.S. basing. But on the other hand, I think there's a real a lack of knowledge about U.S. basing in the United States and the American public. So what I think the book talks about is a story that will be new to a lot of people. It first of all, describes that basis system. It describes the as you say, officially 909, but more likely closer to 1,000 bases that the United States has overseas. And it describes the U.S. military basing policy, which has been under amendment over the last 8 years. It was supposed to get smaller. It was supposed to get more lily pad-like. The United States was supposed to have a smaller footprint around the world because the bases weren't and haven't been that popular in many places. But in fact, the basis system over the last 8 years got larger. That original plan has been shelved in some fundamental ways. But what I also detail in the book and what the authors of the various chapters in the book detail are a set of effects of those bases. It describes how the bases operate. There's a wire. There's an inside the wire. There's an outside the wire. And the effects, the noise, for example, the toxic substances that are in use on the base, the young men and some women who are on the base migrate out. They aren't contained inside the wire. And those effects have been ones that local groups have been at some pains to document, and because they are not all pleasant. And so the book describes a whole series of places where the bases exist and gives us a picture of what those bases are like. I'm just recently back from Guam, where those effects are pretty substantial, and they're engaged in a large buildup there that I'll talk about as we go on through the conversation. But the book describes the base system, and it describes some of the cultural ideas that the base system depends on, some of these beliefs that you just articulated, ideas about the world being a dangerous place in which these bases serve to contain or control.
You call it the gift economy of bases. What's that?
Yeah, that's the belief that the United States is out in this forward position around the world in a version of a kind of gift economy, giving security gifts to the countries in which the bases are located. To some degree, that interpretation has some validity, but in another whole series of ways that it's in fact, just the opposite might be the case. The joke on Guam through the Cold War was nobody really knows where Guam is except nuclear targeters in the Kremlin. So that would be one example of a kind of insecurity that's generated by the U.S. military presence in some of these places. But the book also looks at the social movements that have been evolving in each of these places to try and either ameliorate the effects of the bases or get them out altogether. And over the post-World War II period, in many cases, the bases were evicted from countries where they were because of popular discontent on a whole series of different grounds, sometimes nationalist, sometimes environmentalist, sometimes based in an idea that decolonization required them to leave.
Before you get further into the resistance to the bases, I just want to go back to the beginning. This dawned on me. It didn't dawn on me. Chalmers Johnson wrote about it in a book called The Sorrows of Empire. He's an eminent Asianist, especially in Japan, for 40 years, and he'd spent a great deal of time knowing about Okinawa, but on a trip to Okinawa, it dawned on him for the first time, not only when he counted up the expenses, the golf courses, the criminal reports, etc., that this was kind of a monstrous news to him, that these things were deep trouble, that they behaved exactly the way we think of Soviet bases and the Soviet range of military empire operating, and it sobered him up in a radical way. I'm still wondering, though, that was, I think he said 785 bases at that time. I'm still wondering, even on your map, what does it mean to have 287 bases in Germany? Mm-hmm. What's going on there? Are they post offices? Are they airfields? Who's there? 190,000 American troops mm-hmm. on those bases around the world, but what are they doing? What do they look like?
Well, there are bases large and small. Some are small communications facilities. Some are gigantic bases that take up, for example, in the case of Guam, take up two-thirds of the island. A third of the island, two-thirds left to the population. And so they include airfields, giant Air Force bases, like Kadena Air Force Base in Okinawa or Anderson Air Force Base in Guam. They include very small communications facilities. And again, logistics locations where equipment is stored, arms depots. So they can be small and large. But yes, Germany has an incredible number, as does Korea. Those are the two of the biggest ones.
There have been some famous, momentarily famous exits of the United States forces from overseas bases, including France, Saudi Arabia, quite recently, the Philippines, Vieques, Puerto Rico. Where else are they significantly under political pressure, would you say?
Well, in Eastern Europe, the Czech Republic, Poland. There are movements in many of the countries. In the Pacific, there's a small but very energetic and politically somewhat empowered group of people who are working against the bases.
I kept wondering as I read your book, the real resistance, it seems to me, might actually be in this country, the home base of the United States, if we had half an idea of what's out there. What would happen if we knew about it?
Well, I think when people do find out about it, they often, here's my experience, they often say, oh my gosh, I had no idea we had this many bases. Why do we have this many bases? Oh, I guess we're providing security. They have these horrible effects. And some of the slides that are showing behind us include a picture of a small child who's got severe neurological damage, one of a whole generation of young people in the Philippines who were in utero while their mothers were drinking water that was contaminated with jet fuel from Clark Air Force Base. And so there are, again, a number of elements of the effects of these bases that do horrify people when they find out about them. But ultimately what people will often come to is the conclusion that, well, the world is a tough place, but you have to break some eggs to make an omelet, and the omelet is... It's the American public calling to say that's, in fact, not how they feel.
Can we come back to all of these questions, most particularly not only the opposition, but the question of whether they work, to what effect, what the future of them is, what the underlying both military and political assumptions are that sustain them? We're just well begun. But I'd like to introduce James Dedarian, who needs no introduction. His new book is called virtuous war, and it's going to make famous this MIME acronym, the Military Industrial Media Entertainment Network. If it's not famous already, James, walk us into the zone.
It's okay to snicker when you say that, MIME net. No. It's okay. I know it's a mouthful. But I am clearly sort of cribbing from the farewell address of our past president, Eisenhower, who warned about a military-industrial complex. And I see a new amalgamation, a new virtual alliance where media and entertainment become very powerful actors in why we go to war, how we represent war, and how we fight wars. But this event has been billed very much as a kind of virtual versus a real representation of war. And I want to push that a little bit because this very much is a road trip. The book started off in the early 90s where I went out to the East Mojave Desert to observe one of the first so-called digital rotations where you had an advanced warfighting experiment at Fort Irwin, which is where the Army war games in this tract of land. It's always the size of Rhode Island, these tracts. It's interesting. this tract of land where they completely digitized a brigade and allowed me total access and to get up close to the war machine. And following that is a series of trips to where the industrial side of this comes out in an annual event that I went to where all of the simulation industries would go down to Orlando, where Disney World is, and show their wares. And it was this remarkable spectacle of the cutting edge of information technology and how it's applied to warfare. Went out to Hollywood, went out to the universities where a lot of these technologies are being implemented, and ended up back in the Mojave Desert just last year to see how, hopefully, the military were learning some of the lessons from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Would you, James, just take apart this pun on virtue, virtuality, virtuosity, virtuousness? I also want to know, before we're done, was virtuous war among the casualties in Iraq?
Yeah. Well, I was hoping that would be a felicitous oxymoron, the tension between the idea of war, which is bloody, dirty, messy, and then the whole idea of virtuous, which is this idea that you can do good through something so blunt as warfare. Part of it comes out of the humanitarian intervention, the systems that evolved out of earlier administrations. I don't think we should put this all on the doorstep of the Bush administration. I wanted to make it clear that you see it coming together of the virtual and the virtuous, both in doctrine and in technology. The idea that what we can do should determine what we would should do is part of the notion of virtuous. I mean, at one time, the words virtual and virtuous were synonymous. They sort of went down separate tracks in the Middle Ages. But they always had this idea of producing an effect at a distance, which technology can do. But it was also producing a good effect. Mm-hmm. You know, Christ, in many ways, you know, was a virtual tool of God. The notion in Greek philosophy as well of how gods operated carried this notion of virtuosity. So in some ways, the United States thought almost like in a way as a deus ex machina to use war in this particular high-tech, low casualty, at least for our side, form of warfare to solve some of these you know, intractable problems.
Kathy, I wonder where you would say this intersection goes of virtual theory, virtual networks, virtual strategy, and these extremely unvirtual bases on the ground out there, which have their own complexities and their own shortcomings. But do these two views of the American military machine, so to speak, intersect?
Well, I think there is a way in which, you know, again, U.S. military strategy has a certain kind of elegance to it, a clarity and elegance to it, but then it confronts the theories, let's call them, too, of people in these communities who have another sense of what would make for a more secure life for them individually. Now, some people find their security in employment on these military bases. They sell things in the community that soldiers come out and buy, whether it's jeans or food or women. And so those are different kinds of theories, I guess you could call them, of how to make a good life that are in some contradiction. Some of them are in, you know, mesh nicely for at least for a while. But I guess, yeah, it's not the theory versus the real. It's a series of discourses and theories in some conversation and conflict with each other.
I'd like to ask you, Kathy, and then James. Among the common points here is the magical phrase "war on terror." I mean, it justifies the bases. It might justify a certain amount of environmental damage, et cetera. And it in many of these around many of these bases, it rationalizes the whole cost of things. And in James' case, the war on terror is it's an emotional, it's a media, it's a visual, graphic phenomenon as much as anything else. Make that connection in your own terms, Kathy, of everything you're writing about with this slogan, the war on terror.
Okay. Well, if again, some of the slides that we're showing before come from field work that I've done in the Asia-Pacific region. And just to take one of the images, if it were to come up again, here's the war on terror in Tinian, an island just north of Guam, which has a population of 3,000. But these are the three people who died already in Iraq from that small population. So the war on terror, it comes home into some of these military-based communities, particularly the ones, again, in the U.S. territories. Guam has one of the highest per capita rates of recruitment into the U.S. military. So the war on terror is in the bodies of the folks who are already in these communities, in some cases, the on-base and off-base. The bases themselves are often engaged in with the equipment of these old wars, of the Cold War, of other wars. So the war on terror is really not in much evidence in the actual structure of these bases and what they're about day to day.
Could you sustain these bases without a general anxiety about terror and a war on terror?
No, and that's absolutely the point. The link between the structure of everyday structure of these bases and that argument is quite weak.
Can these bases be credited with victories, partial victories, prevented defeats, et cetera, in a war on terror?
Well, the most visible part of that connection, unfortunately, is in the use of some of the bases as black sites for extraordinary rendition. So Diego Garcia is one of the bases in the Indian Ocean that has that played a role in that way. And, of course, that can be seen as very much antithetical to presenting a view of the United States as opposed to forms of illicit violence. So I think that's a one counterexample to the argument that these bases help the U.S. administration in the war on terror.
James, what does terror have to do with virtuous war? It's waged. I mean, we're often told that the terror networks have their own net-centric theory of confrontation, but spell out the connections.
Well, I think it speaks to the virtualization of the enemy. You know, during the Cold War, we had a fairly obvious enemy other. Powell at one point says, you know, we're being deprived of enemies. You know, all we have left is, you know, the North Koreans at one point. So in one way, when you talk about the war on terror, it's to recognize that the old models, the old paradigms of war, particularly the idea of organized violence between states, no longer holds, and yet the master narrative continues. So you're looking for some other to plug into this notion of the enemy. But I think it also is to recognize the reason why I think the president and others use the term war on terror as absurd as it sounds. It's because we didn't want to recognize the fact you could have 19 terrorists spend about $500,000 and incur about close to $25 billion in immediate destruction, not including, you know, the Iraq war that followed, which is going to probably top out about $1 trillion before we get out of there. So I think to say war on terror is to make the threat so magnified because we don't want to acknowledge how warfare has changed, that you can have these sort of super-empowered individuals through networks, through technologies, basically, you know, bring a superpower not to its knees, but certainly skew all its resources now towards this notion of there being a something out there, amorphous, enormous evil called terror.
Is it possible that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda sort of mastered virtuous war, virtual war, before we did?
This is going to get me in trouble. The idea of bin Laden reading Virtuous War in his cave. No, I don't.
I'm writing it in his cave.
No, that's even worse thought. No, but if you look at what bin Laden, he gave a very famous interviewer that ended up on a videotape, that ended up being translated in 2004, where he talks about how we're going to provoke the superpower, we're going to provoke the crusaders, and we are basically going to beggar them. So he was very savvy about this notion of how to magnify this minuscule, you know, group of really pathological takfiri, you know, the heretic, you know, basically heretic group within Islam, into this colossus, and that would produce this overreaction, called almost an autoimmune response, that where the attempt to cure the would be worse than a disease. And I think in that case, bin Laden was incredibly rational and savvy about how to magnify what was a pretty insignificant force into something that now can play on the same field as a superpower.
Mm. Yeah. Actually, if I can jump in there, I think that's exactly the way to look as well at the U.S. military bases as a response that has a certain rationality but ultimately ends up being a completely overwrought response to the notion of empire, of the desire that the United States has a role, should play it, and can play it in controlling events around the world. Hence, this sort of global spread of these and distribution of these bases is with that dream behind it of global control and global surveillance, global knowledge. And so, the assumption that there's a lot of rationality in the system as a whole, I think we need to rethink that. There's rationality in parts of it. There's different forms of rationalities. And then, but together, they form what we can see as a pretty fantastical system. The Institute for Policy Studies estimates that this basing system costs over $100 billion a year of the U.S. military budget. Mm. Now at over $1 trillion, if you add all the many things that are often not added in when the DoD budget is mentioned, and again put it often at around $600 billion, but it's a very significant investment in a certain kind of idea about the world and the United States' role in it.
Tom Engelhardt's piece in your book, Kathy, spells out Iraq as a kind of case study and an investment in bases that's still building. What has the effect been of the huge setbacks in Iraq, not to mention the change in our presidential leadership, had on all of those plans and the whole theory of massive investment? I mean, the official line is that we're not there in Iraq for permanent bases. Are we?
Well, that seemed to be, as Tom Engelhardt points out in his chapter, it really was very clear from the style of building, the extent of the building, that the United States had the intention to stay permanently. But there was, of course, a long struggle in the Iraqi, in the Court of Iraqi Public Opinion and in their parliament over whether that was going to actually come to pass. But the actually choices that are made in terms of permanence of building materials and so on, and the sheer scale of it, suggested that this was going to be a base that had much more a regional purpose than a local counterinsurgency purpose.
He referred to that whole structure as our first lunar colony. There are a lot of smart...
Not to say loony.
There are a lot of interested folk here, students, teachers, citizens, with questions or comments, but I wonder, before we go to you all, James and Kathy, do you have questions or observations for each other on these two striking books?
Well, I think they complement each other in the sense that I'm a sort of an amateur ethnographer, and while Kathy is a professional, and I realize my limitations, but I think that increasingly international relations is not the correct discipline for understanding the complexities of warfare now. I think ethnography, anthropology, literary theory, religious studies, media studies do a better job. International relations was based on the notion of, you know, relations between states. And what we see here is the rise of a multitude of new actors, super empowered by technologies, usually network technologies, where we've gone past, I think, multipolarity, bipolarity. You've heard this before. We're entering heteropolarity, where there's all these different actors. And the old tools just aren't adequate. So I like to see these two books that are saying, okay, let's open it up to new investigations, new approaches.
Questions from the hall, please.
First of all, I just wanted to comment about the front page article in the New York Times today that showed the president's jet being flown low over skyscrapers in Manhattan as a publicity image for the military. And it gives me pause when I hear James talk about the entertainment aspect of selling the military. So I'm kind of like a comment on the capabilities of people who are making these kinds of decisions. But that's just one thing that crossed my mind. For Kathy, I would like to know, how does the United States respond when there are complaints in host countries of environmental degradation and personal injury claims? And is an attempt made to compensate, to mollify, to in some way continue to convince host countries that indeed these bases are of benefit to them? I think that that probably covers my basic questions.
Thank you. Thank you. Kathy?
Well, I think the United States has often used the government of the country in which the base is located to mediate between itself and the population. There's plenty of public relations work that gets done every day to convince people directly through everything from Voice of America to Armed Forces, radio and TV, which are ubiquitous in these countries, to convince people that the bases are there for their security. But when there are problems, the local government becomes the mediator, becomes the go-to person. So that when the United States, for example, recently moved its bases back from the DMZ in South Korea, bases that it had been at for decades, and then moved back south of Seoul, the bases that were returned to the Korean people were highly toxic. The soil was found to be too dangerous for human use even. So, of course, one also worries about the U.S. Service people who were working on that same site for decades. Obviously, short exposures compared to local populations. But in any case, in those cases, the responsibilities then devolves to the government. So there really isn't an attempt to clean up. It's turned over as a responsibility to the local government.
James, do you want to comment on the first?
Yeah,
the
whole idea of, you know, sending a 747 with two fighter jets on its wings for a photo opportunity just seems so unbelievable. I thought it had to be a cover story for something much more, you know, conspiratorial. But, you know, you never underestimate the stupidity of bureaucracies. I mean, or rather, don't overestimate. You know, basically, the fact that it's quite – the cover story might be real. There's a tradition with Chris, and when I'm on the show with him, I have to get one Benjamin quote smuggled in. And my favorite, which is in the book – we're always supposed to say that, Kathy, by the way. As I said in the book, one of my favorite is from Walter Benjamin, you know, at the time of terror, Nazi Germany. He said, in times of terror when everyone seems to be a conspirator, everyone has to play the detective. Mm. So I think when these kind of events happen, don't take them at face value. You know, I think you have to start doing some detective work. You know, how does this play into some – perhaps it was some kind of weird war game to see how the public would react, you know. I know it freaked out a lot of people, including, for instance, Phil's brother who was in the skyscraper who, you know, immediately texted Phil saying, there's a plane ready to hit our building. You know, was certainly not registered as intended, if that's what it was.
Thank you. Well, on the one end, I wanted to thank you both for these books. My question is, how do you see this network of bases which belong to, we could say, the geopolitical world we are living progressively behind us, being reconfigured or adapted for the necessities of the era of cyber battlefield and cyber warfare that James describes in his work?
I think the cyber war era is still an era of these sort of physical assets of, I mean, and cyber warfare is a physical, involves physical assets itself, right? So, but what I find fascinating is how many different kinds of considerations beyond strategic thinking go into the question of what assets to put where and how to network them. So, for example, in Korea, it's now known that there are, well, the planners know that in, about a half of the people who get assigned to Korea leave the military if forced to go to Korea. They'd rather, you know, leave than go there because it's considered a very unattractive site. And what that means is both that they're working hard to make Korea a more attractive site, but every other place has that same set of considerations. So from Guam, the attempt to make a small sort of, to make the quality of life high, and that means make the place look like America, make it look like, make it have comfortable, familiar sights and smells and places to go. So golf courses, Taco Bell, a suburban land use pattern, which is absolutely striking, particularly on some of these island societies where land is at a great premium, in Okinawa, Guam, and they're just completely sprawled out in terms of the housing pattern. But that's what recruits and retains soldiers into an overseas empire of bases, is feeling at home when you get there. Right? So that means, again, real pressure on land, new land purchases going on in Guam, you know, sort of further challenge to the Chamorro people who live there, who've been slowly deterritorialized over that period. So another unfortunate connection between the virtual and the real in the case of bases.
I've heard a number of speakers in this room talk about how we just can't afford to be maintaining such a military presence. And we can't, and we're in an economic crisis. We have to make hard choices between the military and domestic issues that are very important. And you say $100 billion annual expense for military basing. I'm just trying to understand if the choices will be made between the very unvirtual, as Chris called it, and the virtual. Will we see more drones? Will we see more robots? Will we see fewer people? Will we see fewer bases? Are those the kinds of choices that are ahead of the military?
That's a great question. I'll go back to the president, former general, who inspired my subtitle. President Eisenhower thought you could do war on the cheap after the Second World War, where he began to demobilize, cut back on number of bases, and rely on nukes. Nuclear weapons, mutual assured destruction would make conventional warfare maybe less tenable, less necessary, and act as a deterrent. We don't really have that option because how do you deter actors that don't really have, to use this expression, return address? It's very difficult. You brought up drones and new technologies. It does have a disciplinary effect. If you know you're being watched all the time, it does change your patterns of behavior and perhaps actually have some sort of deterrent effect, particularly if those drones have Hellfire missiles on them. You know, if you get out the wrong exit to your cave one morning, you might not live for the next dawn morning. So it is this sort of incredible dream of some of the worst sort of high-tech fetishists in the military, that there'll be total visibility, total ubiquity of all of these warfighting capabilities. You'll have sensors everywhere, and people in the Air Force like to promote sometimes. So there's a service rivalry here about who promotes this perspective. Because you do need boots on the ground. And it's that kind of hubris that got us into Iraq in the first place. So I think at least two, maybe three out of the armed services have learned those lessons. So it's not going to be, I think, the dystopia that some of our science fiction has imagined for us.
I guess the concept I'd throw in addition is the idea of the carry-on imperative, which I think is really important in understanding military institutions. And that's the notion that there are interests at play in each of these different weapon systems, each of the different bases, each of the different services. I mean, it's been proposed, for example, that the Air Force be disestablished and you know, that this there'd be an incredible economy of scale. Good luck with that one. Right? The corporations that make particular kinds of weapon systems will actually have to be it'll be a gigantic fight to have any of that pulled back, so that I think what you'll end up with is both. Right? And, in fact, these drones are coming to Guam. Right? But they're being added to the Marines and to all these other sort of very non-virtual elements of the military. So, that, again, the idea of, that, of having it all continues to be possible to argue for in a climate where it is very, very difficult to argue that national security needs don't trump everything else.
And I might just add, because I don't want us to all leave this room and totally, you know, bummed out, despondent, you know, reaction to our
Let's
talk.
Let's not do that.
No, because, you know, the F-22, which is, you know, made, you know, in I think something like 45 different states. Parts of the F-22 are made in all the congressional districts.
The B-2 has that.
B-2 as well. And yet this administration managed to stop the production levels that were originally funded. There's not going to be 400 plus. There's going to be under, I think, 100. So that's something to be hopeful about.
Please.
Could I ask a couple of fairly obvious questions about time? And I suppose it's a question about a loss of common measure when you go too fast, in a sense. Is it because there's a sort of loss of common measure that there's no encounter possible, no encounter with the enemy possible, in a sense? So. And so this is why the enemy can only be cast as a kind of zombie.
I always have time for time. You're absolutely right that if you don't have time to talk, there's never going to be any kind of human element to your encounter with others. You might as well. It is a zombification of warfare when you just treat everybody else as, you know, protoplasm, good protoplasm, bad protoplasm, you know, a little icon on a screen. You never really have any sense of, you know, the human qualities of people. And here, I'm going to turn it over to Kathy, because the military is getting it in one level, but this is where Kathy and I probably disagree somewhat, where I think, you know, the military is making an effort, and now I'm going to set Kathy up by saying she believes that it's a lost cause.
Okay. Well, yes, the military is very interested in a version of counterinsurgency doctrine that which would include cultural awareness as one of the most important devices by which wars will be won in that domain. Because to understand the enemy's culture is to defeat him through that process of deliberation and being a better ethnographer than the enemy. And it's also to prevent unnecessary use of kinetic force, this is the theory, by having a culturally aware military force which does not do things like show the bottom of their feet to or touch women in a Muslim country and so on. So that there's an argument for the use of something other than violence to win wars. But I actually, Wendy...
Can I ask, can you do that and play the drones game in the same lifetime? I mean, really, where are they?
Exactly. I think it is fantastical, and here's where, again, James is right, we disagree. I think that the idea that you will be able to successfully occupy a country, occasionally kill civilians, and then use that sort of cultural knowledge to still manage the local politics, manage intercultural relations. It's a quite fantastic dream, I think, of again total control of of politics, culture. The COIN manual that the University of Chicago Press just published last year is really a document of incredible ambition and dreaminess about the possibilities for counterinsurgency, basically suggesting that the military be about the project of economic development, of developing societies that are in horrible shape economically, of bringing democracy at levels and in ways that are not visible in the United States today, of bringing certain kinds of, again, basically, it's Wendy Brown recently wrote something that said basically it's an imagination worthy of the Communist Manifesto, of you know the best of our sort of forefathers and foremothers in anthropology in terms of its dreams of sort of cultural understanding of cultural wholes and so that I think is really quite a very interesting move and sort of contemporary. Moment in the U.S. military is to see that the sort of broadening ambitions about what military strategy should be about.
Could I ask you both, I mean, my instinct as a news person is always to wonder, you know, where is this story going? Kathy, you're talking about bases at a huge cost with considerable damage and resistance out there. James, you're talking about doctrines of warfare that in significant ways came a cropper in Iraq and may in fact have been captured or trumped or reversed by the enemy. What's the next chapter in the stories you've outlined? When will we hear about the base question again?
I think we'll hear about it with budget negotiations the next time the budget is up for discussion and major cuts have to be made. And then people will start to talk about the sort of whole question of should we be scaling back our overseas basing in major ways?
At what risk?
The scaling back of the bases?
Yeah.
Well, obviously, I mean, I think the carry-on imperative suggests that we look more closely at why each of these bases is in each of the places that they're in and ask, you know, what is the advantage of that in an era when, again, there's aerial refueling, there are incredible political costs, particularly where the United States has bases in regimes that have, you know, really bad human rights records. In addition, the local arms races that have been stimulated, the encirclement of Russia and the Chinese sense of threat from the buildup in Guam seems, you know, by some assessments, that's clearly connected to increases in Chinese military spending. And certainly the Russians have complained bitterly about the United States' move of their bases into Eastern Europe and into the, you know, the and South Asia.
James, finally, what is the next chapter, the next reel, we should say, in the story of the military-industrial media entertainment network?
Well, I first would concur with Kathy that economic necessity is going to change the game right now. You're already seeing it in how the military budget's being affected. You're going to have to rely on allies more. You can't go unilateral. You can't do cowboy diplomacy. All those things are for the good. But I think, like Clausewitz, particular wars might be avoidable, but war is still going to be a necessary part of a system that has no central government, obviously, where people are in desperate situations, where the divide between haves and have-nots has worsened because of the economic meltdown. So there's going to continue to be global violence, but there's going to be, I hope, a new effort to sort of manage, mitigate that global violence, to mediate it through coalitions. Mm-hmm. And when you have to convince more than one other state or group of people or your own people that this is the proper action, then I think it's going to reintroduce deliberation time, slow down the process, not have these type of, you know, following worst-case scenarios that plunge us into situations without the proper mustering of public support, making sure that if we don't have an exit visa, at least we have a good sense of, you know, what the costs are going to be before we go in. Hmm. And then once in, learn how to fight with lower, you know, with more considerations about lethality, not just for our side, but the other side as well.
I think that's as close as we're going to get to a to a sunset happy ending in this conversation. It's been hugely interesting. James Dudarian of Virtuous War and Kathy Lutz of The Bases of Empire, thank you enormously from me and from all of us here in the Joukowsky Forum. Sarah Archambault and Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, feedback at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.